Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart will join us in just a bit. Her office released an audit of the city's sexual harassment policies last year. Apparently, the system for addressing the needs of victims was woefully inadequate. Mayor Kenney promised action, and Controller Reinhart will tell us if progress has been made. Also, Penn has conducted research into the closing of two major homeless encampments in Kensington. Where are inhabitants today? Are they in housing or perhaps drug treatment? But to begin, we talk about ghost guns and a law in New Jersey which attempts to eliminate them. In March, four men became the first to be charged under the law, which makes it illegal to buy, possess, manufacture, or sell homemade guns. The men are accused of trying to market six homemade AR-15 semi-automatic rifles, and New Jersey's Attorney General, Grabir Graywall, calls these so-called ghost guns a real and dangerous menace. Here with us now is Adam Skaggs, Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Welcome to Radio Times, Adam.
Thanks so much for having me.
A gun is a ghost gun in part because it can't be traced, correct?
That's right. These are homemade guns that people can put together with parts and kits that they buy online. And the guns have no serial numbers. So essentially, they're untraceable by law enforcement.
Who are these online kits really meant for?
Well, look, these are kits that allow you to put together whether it's an AR-15 assault rifle, whether it's a 9mm handgun. These kits allow you to put together a gun that's essentially indistinguishable, works just as well as a gun that you'd go to a gun store and buy. The big difference, in addition to the fact that they can't be traced by police, the big difference is there's no background check and no questions asked. If you have an internet connection, you can get one of these kits sent to your home and a little work, an hour or two in the garage or working with these parts. You've got a fully functioning firearm put together with no background check. So obviously these are very attractive for the kind of criminal traffickers that were involved in the incident you just described. But whether you're a convicted felon, a domestic abuser, somebody that's it's illegal for you to have a gun and you go to a gun store and fail a background check if you tried to buy one, but you can go online and it's a giant loophole that allows these dangerous people to get their hands on guns.
And my understanding, Adam Skaggs, is that most of the guns which come from these kits are already about 80% assembled. They can't be fired, but this is the big loophole for dealers.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What they do is they sell you all the parts you need to put together a fully assembled gun, but the key part, it's called the receiver in a rifle or a frame for a pistol, the key part that houses the firing mechanism of the gun is not completed 100%. It's only 80% completed. But it's very simple to finish the last 20%. If you have an electric drill, using a drill bit that you can go down to a local Home Depot or Lowe's, or you can buy it along with the parts from one of these websites, just a couple of simple steps and you finish the machining. So it's not something that requires a lot of special skill. Just about anybody can do it. And if you're a person who's legally prohibited from having a gun, as I said, with just a little bit of extra work, you've got your hands on a fully functioning firearm. Hmm.
Attorney General Graywall is looking for manufacturers to assume some responsibility. He says, some of these manufacturers need to flag the fact that sometimes many orders go to one address, and that's a big red flag.
Yeah, it absolutely is. These companies sell these kits. They justify selling these kits by saying these are for hobbyists, these are for gun enthusiasts that just want to build a gun of their own that they can take to the range and use for target practice, et cetera. But if they're selling, dozens of these kits to the same person, well, that sounds a lot more like somebody who's involved in gun trafficking than it sounds like somebody who's a hobbyist who wants to build a single gun. You go to some of the websites that sell these kits, and they'll offer you a discount if you buy a 5-pack, or if you buy a 10-pack, they'll give you an even bigger discount. Well, let me ask you, if you're selling discounted 10-packs of these products, do you think that's for a hobbyist who wants to build a single gun, or is that for somebody who wants to traffic these to other criminals? I think the answer to that is pretty obvious.
And again, Attorney General Graywall, he's sued a California company for ignoring a cease and desist order to stop selling in New Jersey. According to Graywall, this is the first lawsuit in the nation brought by a state against a distributor of such firearms, in this case, U.S. Patriot Armory. What are the chances that New Jersey gains any ground here?
Well, look, I think New Jersey has been really at the forefront in terms of leadership on this issue in the nation. I think Attorney General Graywall's efforts have been important and have been quite successful. Already, there's about 15 of these ghost gun sellers that have agreed to stop shipping these dangerous parts and kits into the state of New Jersey. And we want to see other states follow that lead, frankly. We've been very supportive of the efforts of the Murphy administration and Attorney Graywall in particular in New Jersey. But this is a growing problem everywhere. And, you know, in the case that you described, there was a wire on this criminal gun trafficking ring, and they said they were caught on tape saying one of them, you know, New Jersey changed this law. We can't get these products in New Jersey anymore. We got to ship them to Philly. And these folks shipped these products to Philadelphia, and then they went over across the river and brought the parts back to New Jersey. So this is a real problem in Pennsylvania. We've talked with folks that say the Philly Police Department is seizing more and more of these guns. These are being found more and more frequently. So gangs and other criminal traffickers know that this is an easy way to get their hands on guns that police can't trace. And they're showing up more and more on the streets of Philadelphia, and they're going to be showing up more around the rest of the state as criminal traffickers get wise to this giant loophole in our gun laws.
So fairly easy to get around the New Jersey law. Has there been reaction among legislators, law enforcement in New Jersey to this loophole?
Yeah, New Jersey, the legislature passed sort of first in the nation legislation last year that's addressing these problems. The attorney general has shown real leadership. You know, there are bills that have been introduced in other states around the country that are moving forward this year. So we're hopeful that additional states will follow the lead both of the New Jersey legislature and outlaw these dangerous products, but also that law enforcement, other attorneys general, around the country will similarly take action. You know, I think Attorney General Shapiro in Pennsylvania is certainly aware of the growing problem in cities like Philadelphia, and we very much hope to work with his office as well as with other law enforcement around the country to try and stop this dangerous threat to public safety.
Adam Skaggs is chief counsel and policy director at Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Adam, it's not just online kits, though. It's also 3D printers?
Well, yeah, that's another technology. There are groups and companies out there that want to make what they describe as downloadable guns available to anybody in the country who's got, or the world, really, who's got a 3D printer. So basically, here you wouldn't even have to wait for the company to ship the kit to your door. You could simply, with the click of a mouse, click print, and your 3D printer would essentially manufacture, would build the key components of a pistol. So that's a very dangerous issue as well. And both Attorney General Graywall in New Jersey and Attorney General Shapiro in Pennsylvania actually sued successfully to stop the distribution of these downloadable guns. At this point, downloadable guns are a real threat because they're available to anybody with a 3D printer. Again, whether you could pass a background check or not, they are untraceable like other ghost guns. And when they're built with plastic on a 3D printer, they're also undetectable. So you can imagine the danger of somebody being able to get a gun through a metal detector. The technology, the plastic guns are not as durable. These kits that you can build, once you finish that 20% finish machining them out, they work just as well. They're just as durable and sturdy as any other firearm that you buy at a store. So really, right now, we're concerned about both. But I think what we've seen with trafficking rings is that there has been more embrace by these criminal networks of the ghost gun kits that can be bought online and shipped to finish the assembly.
Okay. Adam, New Jersey is one of only two states in the nation which ban homemade guns?
Well, New Jersey's law really is the strongest in the country. California also has a ban on unserialized guns. So you can still build these guns in California, but you have to apply to the Department of Justice for a serial number and then affix it to the gun and provide proof to the Department of Justice that you've done that. So that's another approach. We think New Jersey's is a bit more comprehensive. There's legislation in other states. New York has a bill that would probably be even yet stronger than New Jersey's. So there are a range of legislative options out there. Giffords Law Center, my organization, is working with legislators and advocates around the country to try and get this legislation signed into law. And we will continue working on this until the threat is addressed. Ultimately, these are kits that allow you to put together firearms, but they don't have any of the regulations that fully assembled guns have. You know, if hobbyists want to build guns, that's totally okay, but they should go through the same background check. They should go through the same regulations they do for any other gun purchase, and that's what we're working to try and achieve.
So State Attorney General Gurbir Graywal in New Jersey is asking Congress for a federal ban on gun kits. Not likely to happen anytime soon, you think?
Well, I think trying to get gun legislation through the Senate is a steep hill to climb. The House, for the first time in a generation, has actually passed several pieces of important gun safety legislation, and we're very encouraged with that. The last Congress, the House wouldn't even take a vote, and already this Congress has passed a bill to tighten the background check system, ensure that we have background checks on all gun sales. They have passed the Violence Against Women Act that tightens some of the loopholes that allow domestic abusers to get their hands on guns. So the tide is turning in Washington. The House is showing leadership on the issue. We need the Senate to do the same. I think the likelihood of the Senate acting on ghost guns in the next couple of years is probably unlikely. But the issue is changing. The momentum is clearly on the side of those who are fighting for gun safety. And I think we will likely see some additional changes in Washington as time goes by.
So, Adam, let's get back to the four suspects in the case in South Jersey and Lindenwald, in which they were recorded talking about buying gun kits online, having them shipped to Philadelphia, and then going and getting them there. What sort of jail time do they face? Do you know? And part two of that is it a deterrent? Or enough of a deterrent, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's absolutely a deterrent. And the fact that they acknowledged they couldn't no longer buy these kits in New Jersey, I think, and had to have them shipped out of state, shows that the law is working. Look, I'm not entirely familiar. These defendants are charged not only with violating the ghost gun ban, but also drug trafficking. The investigation actually began as an investigation into a cocaine dealing ring, and only after they began investigating that did they even realize there was also gun trafficking along with the drug trafficking. So I think the sentences that these defendants face are potentially quite steep, and I think that is a deterrent, not only in a case like this where there's drug smuggling along with the gun trafficking, but in the case of anybody who's attempting to circumvent New Jersey's strong gun laws by trafficking in these homemade, unserialized weapons.
Adam Skaggs, thank you so much. Adam is Chief Counsel and Policy Director at Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Stay with us. Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart is up next. She'll be talking about the city's sexual harassment policies and whether they are improving. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In 2018, the City Controller's Office in Philadelphia released an audit critical of Philadelphia's sexual misconduct policies and payouts. The Kenney administration committed to making changes in the way sexual harassment complaints from city employees are handled. And today, 9 months later, we're asking, has meaningful change happened? Joining us now is Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart. Great to have you with us.
Oh, great to be on today.
So remind us, what led you to audit Philadelphia's sexual harassment procedures in the first place?
Sure. There were a few things that happened that made me feel that we needed to do this performance audit. Back at in the end of 2017, the city made a well-publicized payout of over $1 million for one specific case in the police department of Commander against sexual assault on a female officer who reported to him. And that happened, and he's still on the job today, actually. That happened as well as the sexual harassment of the at the parking authority by Vince Fenerty, the former executive director, and then the sexual harassment complaints against the sheriff, Jewel Williams. All of that happening and made me feel that we need to look at this. We need to look at this for the safety of the city's 28,000 employees, and also from a financial perspective, because the city's paying out money and it's taxpayer money. And if we fix the problem, those payouts should go down. So that's what really made me want to look at it and gave my office the impetus for looking at it.
So one of the issues is different departments have had different policies in effect. Mm-hmm. And so some are, you know, ostensibly worse offenders than others. You brought up the Philadelphia Police Department, Rebecca. Front page of the Inquirer Sunday, Police Inspector Anthony Washington has been accused of sexually harassing at least four female police officers. But as of December, he's been overseeing the Special Victims Unit. And you know, the city also apparently spent nearly $200,000 over a period of years to settle claims against him, including workplace harassment and civil rights violations. So I'm going to jump ahead here and hopefully not put words in your mouth and saying that, you know, this has not been the Kenney administration's efforts to improve the system a lot. It hasn't happened.
That's right. There is the Kenney administration made some changes right after my office's audit came out in July of 2018, made some changes around improving training, improving the policy, and those are good things. But the two main recommendations coming out of the audit, the centralization of complaints, basically having one call-in line that employees can call into that is not within one specific department but handles all complaints throughout the city. That's so important to ensure that the investigation's not biased, to ensure that the discipline can be made more consistent across departments. That has not happened. And I think what we're seeing in this, the case or the article that was on the front page of the paper, what we're seeing is a continuation of the systemic problem. I mean, the fact that the city has paid out close to $200,000 and Inspector Washington is saying that, you know, he's not guilty, but the city keeps paying out, and now he's overseeing the Special Victims Unit. I mean, that's really sort of a horrible thing for survivors, right? And for people that have that go to the Special Victims Unit for protection. I think that several things need to change, and it hasn't. The change hasn't happened yet.
Why not?
You know, that's a very good question. I think that I mean, really, you'd probably have to ask the mayor why there hasn't been more of disruptive change, because I think that's really what needs to happen. In order to do true centralization, things have to change. There has to be a culture change that department heads in some departments have historically just transferred the person, the victim, away from the unit and not handled the perpetrator. And I think that in order to truly address it, that there needs to be true centralization. And the mayor's administration just hasn't done that. I can't speak to it why more than that it just hasn't been done.
So let's talk about where things stand now. As I understand it, Rebecca Reinhart, the employee relations unit is where most complaints go, but at least before your audit, sometimes this was like dropping a complaint into a black hole.
Right. So what the audit found was that in all of the 50 or so departments, many of them were conducting their own investigations, handling complaints. Many complaints were lost or not handled. We found supervisors that got lower discipline for the same level of harassment than junior level employees, which is backwards. So right now, the mayor has this employee relations unit handling most of complaints, is what they're saying. The thing is, though, the departments are still taking in the complaints, transferring them over to the central unit, and then the central unit can give it back to the department to handle. So that defeats the purpose. I mean, often in these instances, you have a junior level employee that's being harassed by a senior level employee, and handling it within the department, it doesn't work. I mean, the bias within the department in favor of the perpetrator is too great.
Well, let's talk about the case of Sheriff Jewel Williams. As I understand it, the audit revealed that an investigation into a substantiated sexual harassment claim against Williams actually ended up before Williams as department head. So he had to offer insight and recommendations on an investigation into his own behavior. Do I have that right?
Yeah, yes, that was one of the audit findings, and it's really unbelievable. Basically, as the department head, as you just said, he was given the results of the substantiated claim against him. And I think that the question still is out there of what to do when there's a substantiated claim against an elected official. I mean, I believe it should just go to the public at that point, because obviously, it shouldn't go to the perpetrator. It was a substantiated claim, so it doesn't make sense to give it back to the person that did the harassing.
So what recourse are you suggesting then for somebody who is in that position of being harassed sexually by a supervisor and might be afraid of having the complaint actually bounced back to the department? What would you advise?
You know, it's so hard, and I have people coming to me right now on a weekly basis, people that are within the departments that don't know what to do. And that's what's so frustrating to me, that there is an answer to this. The answer involves truly changing the process and the system, and it just isn't happening. But in terms of what I would suggest, it's hard at this point because the system's not set up properly to protect people.
Who do you hold accountable?
I hold the mayor accountable. I mean, he's I hold everybody accountable in terms of commissioners, but it rolls up to the mayor and making the changes necessary to protect employees. And the other thing that we need to focus on is the payouts, the city's use of taxpayer money to settle these claims, because I think that has been a longstanding practice, and it really needs to be looked at, because what I've been seeing and what we've been seeing is the law department settles case after case against a perpetrator but doesn't admit any wrongdoing. So then that person, whether it be Inspector Washington that was promoted to head the Special Victims Unit, or whether it's Sheriff Jewel Williams, they've both said, well, we didn't do anything. We didn't do it, even though the city's made these payouts. And I think there's something problematic about that if the city's law department is going to settle a case, there should be some reflection about wrongdoing in order to correct the behavior in the department that allowed that to take place.
Is one of the issues that there is not a firm definition of various forms, or are firm definitions of various forms of sexual harassment on the city books?
Well, I think actually the policy has been updated. So that, to the mayor's credit, the policy has been updated so that there is clear definition. The majority of city employees are good people, right, and not not perpetrators, but of sexual misconduct. But there are some bad actors, just the way there are in any environment or any system.
Sure.
So I think what's happening is that the policy is in place. The definition of misconduct is in place, but you have people that are just repeat offenders that are allowed.
And yet you still have settlements. Even if the policy is in place, you have settlements which are costing the city a lot of money and keeping perpetrators or alleged perpetrators in place.
Right.
So what piece is missing there in order to stop that process?
Well, I think if the city's going to settle a case using taxpayer funds, there needs to be some admission of wrongdoing on the employee's behalf, because the perpetrators, if there's no admission of wrongdoing, then it allows that perpetrator to continue to say that they did nothing wrong and the woman is lying or the person is lying. And it protects the perpetrator over the victim. So I think that there needs to be an explanation. Each time the city makes a payout, I think there needs to be an explanation of that payout to taxpayers. And there needs to be some admission of what went wrong. And if there's changes that need to happen in the department, which often there are, that those changes need to be made. Because continuing to pay out without doing that doesn't make any sense.
And we do have a question from Bernie who asks, how much money has been spent on these lawsuits?
So our audit found that in the five-year period we looked at, 2012 to the beginning of 2018, that about $2.2 million was spent on the payouts. But we think the amount's actually much greater, because one of the findings from the audit was that the law department wasn't tracking the amounts under sexual misconduct cases. So that is something that the law department is working on fixing, but it's real money that's being spent on it.
We are speaking to Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart. Rebecca, your investigation also found that department supervisors weren't given proper instruction about how to handle complaints of sexual harassment. Have you found that this has improved?
I think that the training, the instruction, I can't speak to that specifically, but overall there has been improvement in the training. So there's been an emphasis that the mayor's put on training and on the policy, which are both good steps. And now what really needs to happen is to centralize the complaint line and the investigations to really and truly protect employees when harassment and misconduct does happen.
There was a phone line opened by your office for city employees to report allegations of sexual harassment. But again, this wasn't working properly. Apparently, some of the calls made didn't end up in documentation given to your office by the city.
Well, the phone line that was set up in during the audit was just for audit purposes, was for current or past city employees to call in and discuss their experience with us about reporting sexual misconduct. So our phone line worked, but what it found was that many of the employees, men and women, that called into the phone line and said that they had reported sexual misconduct, we did not get those cases from the official request from the departments. So either the complaints were not logged in by departments, or they were not handed over to us, but it showed that the problem was much bigger than the cases that were looked at as part of our audit.
You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. Rebecca Reinhart, the administration has also said it would work toward a disciplinary schedule for sexual misconduct. What exactly is that?
Sure. So a discipline schedule would be that for different levels of misbehavior, that there would be a consistent discipline or punishment for offenders, right? So what our audit found was that the remedy or the discipline, if a case is found to be substantiated, and there has to be a thorough investigation of any sexual misconduct claim, and it's either substantiated or unsubstantiated. If it's substantiated, then there should be discipline attached to it. So if, for example, a supervisor that is has verbal sexual misconduct and it's a first-time offender and it's one instance, might get a different level of discipline than another supervisor who's had five cases of it, who, you know, deserves much more significant discipline, including perhaps firing, right, at some point. So what we found was that it was really varied across departments and that we needed to have, the recommendation was to have this, a discipline schedule or recommended discipline so that all of the departments would be giving, would handle their employees consistently. And that has not happened. So that's disappointing. I mean, that, is very important too, because I even anecdotally have heard of a recent case where someone's supervisor just got a few days discipline and is back right at the job with the subordinate, you know, there. So I think it's disappointing that that has not happened and that the mayor's administration has not looked to do that.
It sounds like an absolute mammoth task to get this moving in the direction in which you want it to move, starting with centralization. What is the first step, Rebecca?
Yeah, I actually, I don't think it's a mammoth task. I mean, I think that when we need to make change, we just have to go for it, right? And we need to do it. I think the first step would be probably what I said was back last summer when the recommendations came out, that probably we need to start with a few more investigators hired to the centralized office. We need to advertise and roll out a call-in line and basically the new process to say employees call directly to this office and this line, and you'll have experienced people that are that can handle sexual misconduct claims ready to listen to you and to help you. And I actually don't think it's that difficult. There needs to be the will to make that significant change and the will to make a culture change within the department.
So we've got about 5 seconds. Are you optimistic?
Look, I'm always optimistic. I think some things just need a good fight, and this is one that just it's a big problem, and I'll keep fighting.
All right, Philadelphia City Controller Rebecca Reinhart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay Bye-bye. With us as Radio Times continues. Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In January, the city of Philadelphia shut down the last major encampment of homeless people living in Kensington. A total of 4 of these so-called tent cities have been dismantled. Many, if not most, of the residents used drugs like heroin and fentanyl and were addicted. Some kept a supply of Narcan on hand to help revive neighbors who overdosed, and others succumbed to gun violence brought in by the drug trade. Well, research done by the University of Pennsylvania took a close look at the city's work nearly a year ago to clear the first 2 camps and to get residents into shelter and treatment. Was the effort a success? Stephen Matro is the leader of the Penn Study and an associate professor at the University of Delaware's Biden School of Public Policy and Administration, and he joins us in studio. Good to have you with us, Stephen.
Good to be here, Mary.
Let's start first with the process of clearing the Kensington Avenue and Tulip Street camps last year. What were the primary challenges there facing the city?
Well, happened about a year ago. I mean, this city, there were four encampments in total, and they were all under a series of railroad bridges in Kensington, kind of parallel to each other. And they had kind of grown about 50 to 100 people living in each of the camps apiece. They were very prominent. One of them was right along Kensington Avenue, which is the main thoroughfare in Kensington. It was just north of Lehigh Avenue, kind of catty corner from that. There was a Catholic school. They were taking up a part of the sidewalk, just kind of very visible injection drug use. There was lack of sanitation facilities. They were obstructing the sidewalk. So it was a problem. It was a problem the city couldn't ignore. They had to do something about it. On the other hand, they felt very strongly that they did not want to just clear out the camps, have the police come and and roust sure. everybody. This is a group that was homeless, that was in many cases addicted to opioids and also needed help. So the challenge facing the city was what to do. You had two constituencies with very different interests, and the city really facing something that was unprecedented
in terms of
a response.
So the city officials and advocates try to get residents into treatment and housing services. What sorts of services were and are available today? Let's start with housing first.
Okay. So basically, the challenge is, first of all, engaging the people living there. This is a group that, with all of their problems, has kind of been very alienated from society, has had services, is kind of resistant to treatment, and getting outreach to engage people into getting them to come in. First step is either housing or treatment. And this initially is temporary housing. As part of this intervention, the city got dedicated housing facilities, mostly in the area, that would get the people staying in the camps off the streets and have a roof over their head, and they would then work with people. That's one. The other option was drug treatment. So just basically going right off into detox or into a 30 to 45 day treatment program or some kind of other treatment arrangements. And then
was there enough of either housing and drug treatment available for all these people in these 10 cities?
For the people in the camps, yes. The arrangements were made. That's why the two camps were kind of taken on at once instead of all four. There were temporary housing beds that were in the community for the most part local there, and for treatment there were ample beds. And
people who are living on the street are often reluctant to take shelter. Did you talk to these folks out
yes.
on the street as part of your okay? So what did they tell you, Stephen?
So, and this was not just me. This was me and four others who were on the study. And so we basically evaluated the process that the city took. The city took 30 days to engage people, told them this was starting in the beginning of May. Look, we're going to shut these places down. As part of this, we're also going to make housing and treatment services available. So why not come in and take advantage of these services? So there is resistance. Again, many of them had been in the services before. One of the big barriers was that for both the housing and the treatment, it was difficult to get in. For treatment, you basically had to get authorized ahead of time. A lot of times that meant waiting. In some cases, up to a day or two to get into treatment.
Was that lifted during this process, though?
That was lifted. There were procedures that were set in place to basically to circumvent that, to get people into treatment and then worry about identification, who is going to pay for these services after they were in treatment. That was huge. That was a big development in terms of getting people to participate, because people feared going into withdrawal as they sought to go into detox and get treatment. And then on the housing side, the big complaint there was that there were too many rules. There were curfews. There were certain things they can bring in. Many people were kind of partnered with other people who were in the camps, and they would be separated. They did not want that. And so,
how about pets?
Pets were also a problem, and that ended up being kind of a bridge too far. They never The shelters were able to make a lot of accommodations, relax a lot of the rules, relax the curfews, have couples staying together. Pets was never figured out, but again, the obstacles to staying there were reduced quite a bit. And I think one of the biggest accomplishments of this intervention were that a lot of these changes, both on the treatment side and the housing side, were adopted kind of system-wide and are still in place.
So a year later, the Kensington and the Tulip Street encampments are still dismantled. What percentage of that population has actually found some success, found some housing, found drug treatment that seems to be working for them? Do you know?
It's a difficult question because it's hard to say what is success. I mean, again, the goal of this the pilot program was to get people off the streets into temporary housing, into treatment. And so, you know, what kind of a responsibility going forward does a program like that have? What is wanted is not only these kind of temporary housing and treatment services, but then that they move on to more long-term recovery services, to permanent housing, and to kind of move on with their lives. We tracked 189 people who were specifically targeted for engagement. Out of that, I think 24 people, when we stopped tracking people, and this was mid-fall of last year, were on their way to that, either in housing or in long-term recovery services. Mm. About another 24 were still in kind of the short-term treatment services. And then, I don't have the exact number, but probably about another 40, 50 people were continuing to be engaged by by outreach services. So they had not come in for services yet, but they were still in contact with people, and the opportunity was there for them to take services. And one of the things that was learned by the project was that people kept kind of trickling in even after the camps were closed.
To services, to try
exactly,
to find services.
Exactly.
Okay.
And just the importance of having this kind of continued outreach to the people.
My understanding is that even as the encampments have been cleared, there's still an issue with people who are homeless and who are, you know, injecting heroin in parts of Kensington. And your research team has found that closing the encampments in that area was, quote, unquote, the easy part. So closing it down. So what do you mean by that?
We called it the easy part. I mean, closing the camps, getting people into just immediately into services was something that was kind of very specific. You had specific goals. You had, you know, measurable numbers. You had, you know, the camps were shut down. They were, you know, physically the people were moved out. The debris was cleared. It was cleaned up. And, you know, you really, if you go through there now, you really can't tell that there were camps. Very concrete. Same thing with getting people into treatment or getting them into housing. You have specific numbers. And again, these are by no means easy feats. This took a lot of collaboration. This took a lot of preparation. But it was relatively easy compared to the next steps, which are what then happens to the people both who were engaged in treatment and also those who weren't.
What do you think has to happen next?
I think one of the main findings was that on an individual level, this was a success in the sense that the camps were closed. There were a number of people who were staying in the camps who benefited. Unfortunately, the problems of homelessness and opioid use are much bigger than two or even four encampments. So there were a lot of people that left and basically kind of scattered around the community. What happened to those people is a lot less clear for the most part. And also for the people who did get services, you know, what happens to them on the long term is also a much more difficult problem, because once you get them out of the immediate services, then they kind of go into a much more general pool of people in Philadelphia citywide who are looking for long-term recovery services and in permanent housing. And the supply of both of those is much less supply than the demand for it.
When you were talking to residents of these camps, I gathered that's before the operation to dismantle the camps started, correct?
That was during the process of it.
What, on a human level, what did you hear from these folks? What were they telling you? How did they seem?
On a human level, it was very difficult to live out there. These are people who have been through a lot, who continue to be through a lot. I mean, you're talking about, you know, literally living under a bridge, in all kinds of elements, in most cases having opioid addictions that they needed to maintain. So they had been through a lot. A lot of them did want help, weren't quite sure how to get it, were also afraid to get it, kind of took a lot of kind of establishing trust and also just establishing just confidence that there was a path to go to. And so it's, again, there was a lot of need, there was willingness, but there was also resistance.
The Penn study busted some common misconceptions that many residents of these encampments were from outside Philadelphia. Yes. That wasn't true.
Right.
That's not the case.
That was probably the finding that got the most attention out of the whole study, was that we found that 2/3 of the people that we surveyed were actually from Philadelphia, born and raised. There was another, that was 2/3, there's about another 12% who had been in Philadelphia for over a year. So that was upwards of 85% of the people that we surveyed from under the bridges, were from in the encampments, were in fact, you know, long-term Philadelphia residents, meaning that this is a Philadelphia problem. There is, both in the neighborhood and among service providers and everything, just kind of the idea that this is a population. Kensington has this reputation as being a source of potent, cheap heroin. So people kind of come into the area looking for that and kind of being on a drug holiday or something. So if you close these down, you drive people back to where they came from. And that wasn't the case. What we found out was that this is not only a predominantly local problem, but this is also a problem where people had been homeless for a long time for the most part. A lot of people did use the shelter services even though they were reluctant to do so. And this was a problem that the city had to tend to. And to their credit, the city accepted that and went forward with that in mind.
Stephen Matro, did you talk to residents of Kensington?
We did.
And what did you hear from them? Issues, you know, like opening more beds to treat these folks who are in the encampments, a safe injection site, which is now in federal court. You know, what were they telling you, the actual residents?
We were very conscious to get all perspectives on this, and that included the residents. Like I said earlier, you know, the city was really walking a very thin line here between both the needs of the people in the encampments, which you had mostly spoken about, and also the residents. The residents have been through a lot. There's basically been this feeling of being under siege, of kind of being invaded by not only the drug trade, but people using drugs. There's public health concerns. There's, you know, discarded syringes are ubiquitous. You know, people fear for their children, for their safety. And it's understandable. One of the problems there is, you know, again, people for the most part weren't that concerned about what happened to the people there as much as they were kind of out of the neighborhood. You know, the problem was dealt with. So they were reluctant to put in additional services. And they kind of had this feeling that they didn't want to basically have this problem entrenched. There's kind of been a long history of just difficulty being able to trust people in the city. And that came out. That being said, there was room for compromise.
Really?
The city.
What sort of compromise? We only have about like 40 seconds left.
Okay.
So what room?
So the city did get some temporary housing facilities into the area. Not as much as they wanted, but they did get some. And they kind of went back and forth. It wasn't, I think, bottom line, just like advocates for the people living in the encampments weren't totally happy with what happened. People in the neighborhood also weren't totally happy with it. And ultimately, it's a much bigger problem than just clearing out two camps.
More research to come?
More research is definitely needed.
All right, Stephen Matro, great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Stephen Matro is leader of the Penn Study into two homeless camps that were located in Kensington and broken up last year. And he's an associate professor at the University of Delaware's Biden School of Public Policy and Administration. And as always, you'll find links to social media and our podcasts at whyy.org/radiotimes. Visit anytime. Our engineer today, Adam Stanishevsky. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.